If you enjoy podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Beyond the Paper Gown, hosted by Dr. Mitzi Krakover, helps people think critically about women's health issues, encouraging them to question and explore the complexities of healthcare systems, scientific advancements, and societal norms. There's a really cool episode that you should check out called Midday Menopause App, and that's about how AI and sensor technology can provide personalized interventions to manage menopause symptoms effectively. Check out Beyond the Paper Gown on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Raj Sundar, a family physician and a community organizer. You're listening to Healthcare for Humans, the show dedicated to educating you on how to care for culturally diverse communities so you can be a better healer. This is about everything that you wish you knew to really care for the person in front of you, not just a body system. Let's learn together. Okay, welcome back, everyone. This is going to be the first part of our two-part reflection series on latent tuberculosis. And these reflections are based on real interviews conducted with community members and leaders to understand what communities' perspectives, values, and beliefs are around latent tuberculosis. I'm especially grateful for the opportunity to bring together such diverse voices and reflect on common themes in this two-part series. Thanks to Dr. Duncan Reed, Medical Director of EthnoMed and the King County Public Health Team, for their extensive interviews with community members, helping make this all possible. So this episode, I'll be sitting down with Duncan and Frankie Era. You heard from him in episode 42, as a disease intervention specialist from King County Public Health. We'll review clips from the interviews that they had conducted as part of this project to better understand how to address latent TB in our communities. You'll hear from voices like Dr. Jara from the Ethiopian community, Reverend Karume from the Kenyan community, and Disney and Jasmine from the Marshallese community. So the common themes that you'll hear today is around the perception of BCG vaccination, a vaccine often given to infants and small children in other countries where TB is common, but it's not in the US, which informs a lot of reactions and responses in the communities about what to do now. You'll also hear about the understanding of active versus latent TB in different communities, because they're coming from countries where active tuberculosis is a crisis. So latent TB is not the priority. And coming to a country where we're attempting to flip that narrative and talk about prevention takes a lot of intentionality and work. And lastly, the realities of stigma associated with something like tuberculosis. The key idea to remember is that this episode is about specific experiences in specific communities in specific places. Try saying that a few times in a row. However, these concepts are universally relevant. The specific is the universal. Trust, stigma, fear. These concepts transcend geography, and understanding specific situations will help you ask the right questions wherever you are and make this real for you. Because I also believe that we suffer from a lack of imagination of how things could be. And I'm hoping this episode makes it real for you of what it means to build relationships and directly engage with the community to understand their needs and then co-design a solution together. Something that you've heard me say over and over again, and I'll keep saying it because it comes out in almost every episode we do. As I said, this is part one of our reflection series. Stay tuned for part two in the next episode, where we'll explore the voices of the Afghan and Congolese communities in greater depth as well. Let's get started. Here's Duncan, Frankie, and many, many others. Duncan, Frankie, welcome to our podcast in Healthcare for Humans. I'm so excited to do this new and interesting thing with you where we actually listen to community voices to talk about what's on their minds and what it means to make healthcare better and serve them in the way they want to. Before we get started, can I get a quick intro from both of you?
Yes. Hi, my name is Frankie Era. I'm with King County Public Health. I'm a part of our newer unit that's focused on raising awareness about latent TB. I lead a lot of our community outreach and engagements.
Thanks, Frankie.
And I'm Duncan Reed. I'm a primary care physician at Harborview Medical Center in the International Medicine Clinic, and I'm also the medical director for Ethnomed, based at ethnomed.org. And we have been recently working with King County Public Health, with Frankie and his team, to better understand TB in the community here.
Thanks, Frankie and Duncan. I'm excited to do this with you. Duncan, let's set the context for today. We're going to hear from a lot of voices today. We're going to hear from a representative from the Ethiopian community, from the Kenyan community, Congolese community, Marshallese community, and the Afghan community too, which is a lot of voices. Tell me how you went about doing this and the overview of what questions you were trying to answer.
So the background of this is that I'm really hopping onto a project that has been spearheaded by King County Public Health with this very unique community navigator program, in which they have community liaisons to a number of different communities. I think it's over 24 communities. The basic thing that it comes down to is that there's still active TB disease in King County. The majority of these cases occur in people who are born outside the US. So about 80 to 90% of TB disease cases occur in people that were born outside of the US. So King County already started to identify these communities and trying to increase the amount of screening that was done in these communities. However, what happened is when they were trying to do these screening events, there wasn't a lot of uptake in the communities. For example, they did the Marshallese community just for some screening, and then a lot of people didn't show up, and it was very problematic to follow up. What they began to understand is that in each community, everyone has their own narrative of what tuberculosis is based on where they're from, what their experiences have been back home, and their own interactions with the medical community here. So because of this, we realized that working together, King County Public Health, TB program, and ethnomed.org, we could come up with profiles, which we really focus on the experience and understanding of each community based on interviews, and use this to create profiles that we can share both with providers and with patients.
What a great project to directly hear from the community. And I can imagine, I feel like this happens a lot, where we know there's a lack of screening and we say, here's the screening, and then no one shows up and we're confused of, you said there was no screening and here's the screening and why isn't it happening? Because we didn't start with the community first or what people are thinking and what their values and beliefs are and how to address all the components of why there's such a increased risk of tuberculosis in certain communities.
So in clinic, I talk to the residents and I say, hey, have you ever taken care of a Marshallese patient? And they're like, oh yeah, I took care of a Marshallese patient. And then I come up with a case report and I say, hey, you're in the hospital. This is a patient based on a patient I saw. 60-year-old man, he comes from the Marshall Islands. He emigrated not too long ago. He has very poor renal function. He has a cough that's been going on for about 1 to 2 months and really doesn't feel comfortable in the hospital, really wants to leave, doesn't seem very trustful. So then I talk to the residents and I say, hey, what do you know about the Marshallese community? And how can that inform your care? And what people will say is, oh yeah, I took care of this Marshallese person. Oh, they had really bad renal failure and then something. And it was hard to get an interpreter. So then I said, what else do you know about them? And they say, they don't, not very much. So I bring it up and then I say, this is for any culture that you're talking to, you probably need to know some fundamental things to be able to understand which diseases you need to target and how to best deliver care. So in the case of the Marshallese community, I bring up and I put up an image and I say, do you know who this guy is? And most people know. And I say, where does he live? And they say, oh, he lives on a pineapple under the sea. And I said, but where? And they're like, Bikini Bottom. So then I ask, do you know that Bikini Bottom is a real place? And they say, oh, I didn't realize that, in the Marshall Islands. So at the end of World War II, there were two atomic bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. After that, the U.S. developed an even more powerful nuclear weapon called the hydrogen bomb, which was 1,000 times more powerful. And we looked across the earth about for a place where we could test this. We settled on this beautiful atoll called Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands, and we detonated it. There were dozens of more detonations that occurred. And now the Marshallese community has a very high rate of tuberculosis in the islands, and I think it's inarguably linked to this history of military occupation and testing. And then I point out, this is the Marshall Islands, but that same type of history, in 2 minutes, you learned a little bit about the Marshall Islands history and the fact that you need to screen for TB. But imagine all the other community groups that exist. And what can we do that's similar to that and raise awareness not only of their history, but also of their own relationship with these diseases and understanding?
Yeah, what an important point to bring up, Duncan, to provide a little bit of context to sometimes the source of distrust and the prevalence of certain illnesses and how much we need to understand and listen before we think about, quote unquote, fixing the problem. So I really appreciate that context to provide some information on why we're doing what we're doing today. And it's going to come up, I think, in one of the voices that we're going to hear today about their experience understanding about this horrific testing that happened in their own islands. What we're going to hear today is going to be around a few different themes that community has vocalized pretty strongly about their beliefs about vaccination around tuberculosis, which is there's BCG vaccine all around the world. In the United States, not many people get it, but around the world, people get vaccinated for TB. We're going to hear about the difference between latent TB and tuberculosis and what people's experience has been around that. And then lastly, around stigma. Stigma can feel like a big word, but when we hear it directly from the community, we're going to understand all the nuanced parts of stigma. And then hopefully we're going to unpack what we could do differently to care for this community and create a path forward in what we call eradicating latent TB, which is our goal, right? To prevent these communities from getting tuberculosis and being disproportionately affected by these illnesses. I would love to start out with the idea of the BCG vaccine first. Duncan or Frankie, could you actually tell me what your understanding of the BCG vaccine is? And then we're going to hear from Dr. Jara from the Ethiopian community about what his experience was with the BCG vaccine.
I guess the main message that we share when we reach community during our outreach is that BCG vaccine was intended really to protect very young kids against very serious forms of TB. But unfortunately, it does not protect against the infection or developing active TB disease.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it as well. I'm not an expert in it. But the BCG vaccine, there's a website, the BCG Atlas, where you can look up and see which countries and what prevalence of BCG vaccine is given. And I think it's a combination of historical reasons in the United States why the BCG vaccine had not been routinely administered, and now just because of decreasing incidence and prevalence of TB, it's not administered.
Yeah. Let's hear from Dr. Jara from the Ethiopian community and Reverend Paul Karume from the Kenyan community now.
I'm Ermias. I'm internal medicine doctor. I'm originally from Ethiopia, and I have been a practicing medical doctor in Ethiopia before moving to the US.
Yeah. So BCG vaccine is one of the common eight vaccinations that are given during childhood, and the coverage is relatively good. I assume it is more than like 70-80%. And I don't think people really remember about the vaccine, and I don't think they question how they acquired the disease after vaccination. The vaccine is weak. It's probably preventing severe form of disease, but not preventing the disease at all.
My name is Father Paul Karume. I'm serving in a Episcopal church. I come from Kenya. I'm here like a mission in one way or the other. And I have interacted with so many people of my community, and especially when we are doing this community work in Kenya, we get a prevention of the TB immediately when you're born. You get a shot, which is a BCG. And we have that mark all the days of our lives. So whenever you want to know a Kenyan person, you see that mark of a BCG, which is always on our hand. The other thing is that, like here, we get shot of flu, we get shot of pneumonia. Maybe they don't leave marks, but that one normally leave a mark because that one, it reacts and explode your skin. So that mark will forever be there. What I know about the shots of the TB is that for each and every shot you get is like those bacteria of the TB is the one which are maybe the good one, which you're being put in your body so that they can fight with any kind of a TB which can come to yourself. And mainly what is happening when we migrate and come to this country, when you look to us, you're going to fight the TB because already there are things which are working on us, which are preventing us. And these have made so many migrants even to fear. Because back in our country, the TB, which is not curable, people are related with HIV.
I'm processing some of what we just heard. I think for me, at least, what I'm hearing is how prevalent BCG vaccine is. We don't understand it in maybe the US or Canada, but everywhere else, everybody's getting these vaccines. And it's a live vaccine, and you're getting marked. And the idea of getting a vaccine to protect you from illnesses makes sense. So then I can imagine being in that situation and somebody coming to me and telling me, actually, the vaccine didn't work at all. You might still have TB, and how confusing that would be for me. But what are you all thinking? What does Dr. Ijara and Reverend Paul Karumi's comments make you think of?
I think they're echoing something that came up with a lot of the other communities that we talked to. I think the fact that there's a scar left by the BCG vaccine makes it a very visible token. The fact that you can point to the scar, you say, I have been inoculated against this. Across the different groups that we've seen, there's been various ideas of how much protection it provides. So it hasn't been consistent. The fact that it's given around birth or at very young age, a lot of people don't remember getting it.
Frankie, what's your experience with the BCG vaccine in the communities?
So we do some community presentations, tabling, but a lot of times when we bring up TB, the vaccine is always brought up. We including try to bring up a lot of people have latent TB infection, and many do not know it. A lot of response saying, oh, I'm good. I've received the BCG vaccine. So I'm protected from TB. That makes sense because a lot of people that we talk to when we engage in the community, they're aware of the vaccine and their belief is that they're protected.
One of the things that didn't come up in these two clips is something that I think even as providers here in the US are quite familiar with, is that you can get a false positive with the skin test, with your typical Mantoux skin test, because of a prior BCG vaccination. Things have changed with the QuantiFERONs or this interferon gamma release assay testing typically does not have that false positive caused by the BCG vaccine. But in the community, what I've noticed, and even in the Kenyan community, was that because they have a history of receiving the BCG vaccine, whatever latent TB testing that is done is not valid and there will be false positives. And they extend this logic not just to the Mantoux skin testing, but to the QuantiFERON.
That's true, yeah. I hear that a lot too during outreach.
Yeah, so few things I'm hearing when I say this back to you. One is there's mixed perception of how protective the vaccine is. For some people, they really feel like it's protecting them a lot. Other people know it's not that great and just for children. There's also mixed perception of how long the vaccine is effective. Like for the rest of your life, you can never get TB, or does it wane after some time? And then this third part, Duncan, that you brought up, which I think we've done so much health messaging around it initially, and now we're saying there's a better test. And that pivoting is always hard. We said this test can be positive, even though you don't have latent TB because you got the BCG vaccine. But now this emphasis of we have this blood test, which is actually even more accurate, so we won't get the false positive. And have we done our work in communicating that and educating folks at all levels? And I think that there's a gap there too. Does that sound right to you all?
Yeah, that sounds correct to me. And I think the other confusion is that there's no consistency of whether testing is done with the interferon gamma release assay, this QuantiFERON, or done with the Mantoux skin testing. So there's still a mix of these two tests. So I think that adds to the confusion because people aren't necessarily thinking about what testing they're getting and whether that will be in fact impacted by a prior BCG vaccine or not.
Let's now talk about this idea of latent TB. I feel like it's so confusing to explain to folks that there's an entity called tuberculosis and this other one called latent TB. Number one, latent is a medical jargon. It's not something that people use commonly. But this idea of there's something in your body that could be activated at some point, but it's not harming you now, can be confusing for people to understand when their lived experiences. People are really sick with tuberculosis or not, and you're feeling okay. Let's hear from Dr. Ijara from the Ethiopian community again, and Disney from the Marshallese communities about their experiences, and then we'll reflect on that.
No much awareness about latent TB, especially in Ethiopia. It is only after trying to introduce NIH prophylaxis for patients with HIV infection that latent TB start to get more attention. Otherwise, it is only symptomatic people who will get tested, diagnosed, and recommended for treatment. So latent TB awareness is not there, and it is also not like a priority for addressing it as public health problem, because active TB by itself has high prevalence. And because of that, most people, if you screen them, they can be test positive. In such kind of prevalence, trying to treat all that is difficult. So the awareness is low. Yeah. So when people move to the US, that is universally recommended testing. And when they are tested for TB while they have no symptoms, that is sometimes a big surprise for them. I heard most people wondering, why do they test me? I don't have any symptoms. But they say, I was told that I have tuberculosis.
My name is Disney Alangalur, and I'm working as a disease investigation specialist. The main word that I use is sleeping TB, which means the bacteria is there, but because of the immune system is strong to contain it, the people don't feel the sickness or symptoms until they have either diabetes or some condition that can make the immune system get weakened. So that's when the TB can wake up.
And do people buy it? Because even these American people that I talk to about it, they're like, if it's asleep, then I don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, some of the Marshallese patients, they say, so why do we get the treatment if you don't feel sick? What is the purpose of taking it? And the way I explain to them is, it's better to take preventative treatment because you don't know when you will get sick.
What did y'all think about Disney and Dr. Jara's comment? I'm thinking about how the idea of true empathy on understanding somebody else's lived experience, of imagining somebody in a country where the highest prevalence is of active TB. So latent TB is not a public health priority. So no one's ever told you you need to be watching out for this. And this abrupt change when you come to US and all of a sudden you say, no, you've been sick the whole time and no one's told you. And how much of a shock that it would be for me. And how I would say, no, I was just in a country where I knew what sick looked like for tuberculosis. I'm not sick.
Yeah, I think a good starting point is to think about, what is it, 1 out of 3 people in the entire world have latent TB. So when you think about those numbers, it's extremely high in a lot of TB endemic regions. And I completely agree with you, Raj. It's just understanding what health systems people came from. I think a nice potential analogy would be, in the US, a lot of us got chickenpox. But imagine if they would test you for latent chickenpox, and then they'll tell you, hey, you have chickenpox, but don't worry, it's not active chickenpox, it's latent chickenpox. And if you heard a phrase like that, it might be confusing, and you'd be like, wait a minute, do I have chickenpox or not? And I think that same kind of similarity, right? Because a lot of us do have what you would call latent chickenpox. We just don't refer it to that way. And we don't actually treat it unless you consider getting a zoster or Shingrix vaccination at the age of 50. So it was news to me. And the only other place that I'm aware of that was testing and treating latent TB, which was asymptomatic, was in the Marshall Islands as part of their WHO campaign, which was done a few years ago. And I think if you even try to explain latent TB to Americans, it can be very complicated, let alone to people who have never even been exposed to the concept of latent TB.
I love that analogy because it's way more relatable, I feel like, for many folks, of this idea of what it could feel like. Frankie, what do you think with Disney talking about metaphors and analogies? I think Disney uses the word sleeping TB. We use that idea in some other places, including hepatitis B, of something is in your body, but it's not harming you yet, but it has a potential to. That's the first part. And then educating people that will treat it ahead of time to prevent it from happening. Do you use anything else, or do you talk about the idea of sleeping TB2, Frankie?
So the screening project that we had done with the Marshallese community a few years ago, I used sleeping when I was trying to explain LTBI to folks. And it seems like a lot of people were understanding latent TB better by explaining that it was sleeping, it can wake up at some point in your life. For a lot of folks that understood the concept of sleeping, they were really interested in wanting preventive care. So I guess it's really speaks more to a cultural literacy that can help us communicate what we want to communicate to folks. So for specifically in the Marshallese community, sleeping TB is a good way to share, talk about late TB.
That's great. Yeah, I think I want all of our listeners to understand that idea. And if you have other metaphors, we want to know about it too, because it's such an essential part of health communication and how to translate this foreign abstract idea into something that makes sense or something that we can grasp.
I've heard from a few of our navigators that they really like the use of inactive TB. When I ask them, what do you think about inactive TB? They first think about active TB, how people are sick, you can be contagious and things like that. And then when they think about inactive TB, they think the opposite, right? You have the germ, you're not sick, and you can't spread the TB germ. So when they think about inactive TB, they think the opposite, direct opposite of active TB. So inactive is what I've from navigators is a good way to explain LTBI.
Frankie, that's so great. I keep coming back to how I think the medical and scientific community, we use language that makes sense to us. I don't actually use the word latent in any other setting. I'm not going around saying things are latent right now. And I think we've become so used to using it for TB that we think this is the right way to communicate this idea, right? When, as you're saying, Frankie, what about the obvious? One's active, one's inactive. Why don't we just call it inactive TB? And it's going to make so much more sense.
I think, Raj, you're bringing up another point too, is that a lot of these communities are not English speaking, right? Marshallese is not English speaking. So what does latent actually get translated to? Oftentimes, I think latent is a technical term. So perhaps, Frankie, part of what we can do is just document what people are actually using as terminology in each of these groups or what the interpreters tend to use, because I think each interpreter probably differs even within a language in which term they use.
That's an excellent point. It makes me think of how we need to be well connected with the interpreters too, rather than somebody who's just a conduit, but actually part of our team and reflecting and debriefing of what worked well and what should we do differently in the future. Let's move on to talk about stigma. And this is going to be a big category with a lot of nuances. Let's start with hearing from Disney and Jasmine from the Marshallese community first.
What about stigma? Is stigma a big thing?
I would say yes, here in the state. I even see some back home, but not really a lot. But that's one thing that I see here is they have their feeling that if people knows that they have TB, they have the feeling that they probably may don't want to stay with them, or they may kick out from if they stay with the people.
Okay, so they'd be treated differently. And the interesting thing that we heard from other people too is back home, it wasn't a big stigma. Maybe because everyone already knows your business. But apparently here, it's much more stigmatized.
Hi, my name is Jasmine Alec. I was born and raised in Oregon, so I'm American. But I'm full-blood Marshallese. My parents are Marshallese. I was going to say the fear of getting kicked out or like, they don't want you living there, or because a lot of people, it's not even just like just immediate family that live with each other. It's not just brother, sister, mom, dad. It's cousins, aunties, uncles, in-laws. It's like hard to live here. It's expensive. In the Marshall Islands, you have other options. Family's everywhere. Here, it's not like that.
So there's a lot more interdependence here, even on more extended family.
Yeah.
And you don't have a lot of other options. So anything that can jeopardize your relationships with any of these people.
Wow, both Disney and Jasmine speak to how real the stigma and isolation is. It's come up in conversations in some of the other episodes about how we make stigma seem like not a real thing. What I mean is that, hey, it's not something you should be worried about. 1 in 3 people have it. We'll treat you, it'll get better. And we're trying to almost gaslight people into thinking the stigma is made up and we can convince them that they don't need to worry about it, when actually there's real consequences for them when they're living with family, and family is rightfully so worried about getting TB themselves in their own country where they're coming from. You want to have isolation, so they're trying to replicate that a little bit. I thought that was so powerful. What did you all think?
I think it's bringing up a lot of themes that came up with COVID-19, right? Where if you had COVID-19, you were supposed to isolate. I think the original recommendations were for quite a long period of time. And when you think about a lot of these immigrant communities, that's just not possible based on their housing situation. When you extend that to tuberculosis, where if you have an active case of tuberculosis, you're requiring a period of isolation that's even longer. In a multi-generational household, right, looking at the practicality of it, you're like, how is that even possible?
Frankie, does what Disney and Jasmine said resonate with you? Is it true for a lot of people in the Marshallese community?
I believe so. Now that I'm hearing this, I've heard from my outreach a few folks sharing like their experiences with TB back home and how a lot of people in the community know that they have TB and they seem pretty fine with it, right? But here it's totally different. When I open our clinic, contact investigations, people are more to themselves. They're more reluctant to share who they're around a lot. So I definitely see that here, the differences between home and here. And I guess one other thing as part of stigma, right, with tuberculosis, a lot of times it's like just 1 or 2 breadwinners in the home. So if they're worried about tuberculosis, they're also worried about how are they going to provide for all of these family members in their home. So a lot of folks might deny TB, right? You know, I don't have TB. I'm good. I'm not sick. And if I'm sick, I took medicine for a few days, a few weeks. So now I'm good. I don't have to worry about it anymore. I can go back to work. So I agree with a lot of what Jasmine and Disney shared.
Why do you think it's so different from home, the Marshall Islands in here? Is it this idea of there's nowhere else to live, multi-generational household? Why there's such a big difference in perception and stigma?
I'm trying to understand that too. It could be from what Jasmine had shared. Folks are just worried that they might not have other places to stay. Back home, like Jasmine has shared, we have families everywhere, right? So there's definitely more options if we can stay with somebody else. So I think a lot of it could be that, but I'd be curious to know like what that is also.
Yeah.
One thing that came up in some of our interviews with Marshallese was that there's no even expectation of privacy in a lot of their living situations in the Marshall Islands. And during that WHO intervention where they were actually doing screening of everyone, when people were being treated with directly observed therapy, everyone said it was very clear who was getting daily visits from public health. Is it clear? Do people know each other's business pretty clearly back home?
I want to say yes.
Strangely, here they have more anonymity. And then because of that anonymity, there's this increased privacy. And then the stigma, for some reason, seems to stem from that.
I know we're all trying to figure this out. It's almost more normalized when everybody's up in your business. Like everybody has TB. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Here, no one knows who has it. And you don't want to be the one that's telling people I have TB and be worried about the reaction because you don't know who has it and who doesn't. The sense of safety is lost because of how some of these societies, especially in Western world, US, Canada, where we're individualistic, privacy is really valued, right?
I think that's a great point. And some of the communities that we interview, we're like, do you know anyone with TB? And they're like, no, never heard of anyone with TB in my community or anything.
Yeah.
And it becomes pretty clear that people are just not talking about it. And it's not something that's safe to be discussed.
Yeah. And I want to call out, Frankie, the point that you made before we forget it about when we come in with these ideas of we need to identify and treat latent TB, our primary value is health. When we go to a family or individual, they have a lot of things that's important to them, including money, because they need to survive in a place where there's no social safety net. And there's multiple people to support. So if you're saying, why don't you care about this? It's going to be so important for your health. Sure, it is important to me, but I need to live and support. And there's so many other things that are important to me that I have to deprioritize. And that could be life-threatening in itself because we don't have the support system. And I think we don't acknowledge that enough. So people feel not heard or seen when they're experiencing something like this and say, no, I understand light and TV is important, but you're not giving me great options here.
I agree. Yeah. Because I think one of the big reasons why, at least for our community, folks from the Marshall Islands, one of the big reasons why we migrate to the US is for healthcare. So if they're not thinking about that right now, it means there's other things that they're worried about. Right? It's not that they don't want to do this. It's just not as high a priority at the moment. Definitely agree.
Someone from the Congolese community put it pretty succinctly, because I always ask him, how important is TB? He's like, look at me. Look at how many problems I have. Housing is a problem. Job's a problem. Immigration status is a problem. All this other stuff is a problem. And the last thing I need is another problem added onto what I already have. His life is already tough enough. And framed like that, I'm like, that's a reasonable approach.
Thanks again, everyone, for joining me on another episode of Healthcare for Humans. If you liked this episode, as always, my ask to you is please share it with one other person and go to healthcareforhumans.org to sign up to be part of the community. I'll see you next time.
If you enjoyed podcasts like this, you should check out our other shows on Health Podcast Network. For example, Beyond the Paper Gown, hosted by Dr. Mitzi Krakover, helps people think critically about women's health issues, encouraging them to question and explore the complexities of healthcare systems, scientific advancements, and societal norms. There's a really cool episode that you should check out called Midday Menopause App, and that's about how AI and sensor technology can provide personalized interventions to manage menopause symptoms effectively. Check out Beyond the Paper Gown on your favorite podcast platform or visit healthpodcastnetwork.com.